the U.S. war in Afghanistan started in 2001 after the attacks on September 11th, it continues to this day. It's sometimes called a forever war, and after nearly two decades, it holds the title of the longest-running armed conflict in American history. Now, in a new bombshell investigation, the Washington Post has uncovered thousands of previously secret documents and interviews showing senior U.S. officials have knowingly misled the public for years about the progress being made in the war and the chances for success. Craig Whitlock is an investigative reporter for the Washington Post. He's the reporter behind its investigation into what are being called the Afghanistan Papers. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about what it took to get these records and what these records are in the first place?
Sure. So these records are interviews with more than 400 people who played a direct role in the war at all levels, from generals and ambassadors and White House officials down to aid workers or military troops in the field. These interviews were conducted by an obscure government agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan as part of a lessons learned project, they called it. But they suppressed most all of the findings in the interviews, and we tried to obtain them under the Freedom of Information Act, but it took us more than 3 years and two lawsuits in federal court before we were able to obtain all these documents.
And what you do in your reporting on this in many cases is to stack side by side what officials were saying behind the scenes in these reports and what they were saying publicly. What did you find when you compared and contrasted?
Well, I think people remember the public talking points of the war have been pretty consistent all along. Commanders in the field, presidents at the White House, secretaries of state have always said, well, it's a tough fight. There's challenges, but we're making progress. They would always say, we're making progress. The strategy is sound. We're moving in the right direction. And yet in these interviews, in very raw terms, many of those same people and other senior U.S. leaders were describing their own strategy as a disaster, saying that they fundamentally didn't understand Afghanistan. Their plans didn't make sense. There was a lot of infighting. In short, a completely different story from the line that was being fed to the public.
I want to listen to some of the audio you were able to obtain. First, Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor. He was also previously a military intelligence official, a lieutenant general. Here he is being interviewed by a government agency about problems in the war in Afghanistan.
Never mind, not accomplishing our mission, but the just severity of corruption in our own system, you know, I think is just unbelievable. And you know, I mean, the waste that I saw is unbelievable. And, you know, you sit there and just kind of go, you got to be kidding me. Why do we do this, you know?
And this is another recurring theme in your reporting on this. The United States put a lot of money, not just into the direct military effort, but into various kinds of aid and support in Afghanistan. And a common theme here is the corrupting influence that had. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the biggest problem with corruption really started to occur, I think, under the Obama administration during Obama's troop surge into Afghanistan, when he sent 100,000 troops there. There was a real rush to try and build up the Afghan government, build up the infrastructure in Afghanistan to essentially modernize a country at a really fast track, because Obama only wanted to keep U.S. troops here for, you know, at most a couple of years for this surge. So we've kind of flooded the country of Afghanistan with billions and billions of dollars. And in the interviews we obtained, people are saying they quite literally couldn't spend all the money they were required to, that there was no rhyme or reason to it. They were just under such pressure to show that they were spending money. It didn't matter what they were spending it on. And a lot of that money directly and indirectly ended up in people's pockets. And to this day, the corruption levels in the government of Afghanistan are, you know, a real drawback in the whole war itself, because the Afghan people see their own government as corrupt and are much less likely to fight for it.
Talking to Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at the Washington Post, talking about the Afghanistan Papers, documents that they obtained in Freedom of Information Act, documents and interviews showing two messages, one inside the U.S. military and diplomatic service of pessimism, one public message, more optimistic, highlighting progress they saw around the corner. Craig, wanted to talk about the clarity of mission here. This is another theme that keeps coming up. It's not clear to a lot of the principals here what American goals were in some ways from the beginning.
That's right. And I think to most Americans, they would, you know, that makes sense, right? The what are we trying to accomplish in Afghanistan? People have a lot of questions about why we're there, what we're trying to do. But what was remarkable about these interviews is how the people in charge themselves wondered why we were there or said that the mission was muddled or murky. I think at the beginning of the war, people all understood why we invaded Afghanistan in 2001. It was in response to the 9/11 attacks, and it was to try and destroy al-Qaeda. But within 6 months or so, al-Qaeda's leaders had either been captured, killed, or had fled the country, like Osama bin Laden, who went to Pakistan. So we really eradicated al-Qaeda from Afghanistan early on. And in these interviews, people are saying that's when the mission changed. That's when the war changed. That's when it became unclear why we were still there. What were we trying to accomplish? Who was the enemy is even a phrase you hear time and again from people at the top, but also in the middle and in the field. They quite literally said, we weren't sure who we were fighting. Where are the bad guys? Show me the bad guys. That's what some of these people said. And you know, if you're in a war and you can't tell who the enemy is, you're probably in a difficult situation.
And you also got audio of Ryan Crocker, former ambassador to Afghanistan and Pakistan, talking about this. Even the good guys, the people on our side, were not morally crystal clear here. Here he is talking about a man named Fahim Khan, an official in the Afghan government. Quick warning to listeners, this may be disturbing to some.
He was giggling, and he proceeded to relate to us that a mob had gotten out of control at the airport and had murdered the Minister of Civil Aviation. And he giggled while he related this.
Crocker goes on to say that reports later said Khan himself had had this official killed. This is where former Ambassador Crocker picks up on that individual.
But I certainly came out of those opening months with the feeling that even by Afghan standards, I was in the presence of a totally evil person.
So this is how a U.S. official is describing somebody theoretically on our side, Craig.
Well, not just somebody on our side, but Mohammad Fahim Khan was vice president of Afghanistan and defense minister for years and years till he died in 2014. And this conversation that Ryan Crocker had with him was in 2002. Fahim Khan was a warlord from the northern part of Afghanistan, and his troops from the Northern Alliance worked with the CIA and the U.S. military to topple the Taliban. So they were a key military ally early on in the war. But as here's Ryan Crocker, who is our ambassador in Kabul, meeting this guy, Fahim Khan, who went on to become defense minister and vice president of Afghanistan, and describing him in kind of blood-curdling terms as a real evil person. Yes, so this is our ally, and this was a really problematic, fundamental issue with our whole presence in Afghanistan, who our friends were.
Another story you share was about corruption at the key, Afghan bank. U.S.-backed investigators in Afghanistan were trying to crack down on corruption there. What happened when the Afghan government found out about that?
Well, there was the Kabul Bank was the biggest private bank in Afghanistan, and around 2010, it started to be a public run on the bank. People were worried that they couldn't cover their deposits, and people were literally lining up in the street. And there was a real concern that the whole bank would melt down. The problem was the U.S. government had helped support this bank indirectly, and yet the people who were in charge of it had been looting it with hundreds and millions of dollars of unsecured loans to themselves and their friends, including Fahim Khan, the warlord who was quoted as being evil. Rather than really push the Afghan government to prosecute people, the U.S. government in public kind of made a stink about it, but behind the scenes kind of backed off because the fraudsters in charge of the bank, again, were friends of the United States and leaders in the U.S. in the Afghan government. So it became kind of a politically untouchable situation.
We're talking to Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post. We're talking about his reporting on the Afghanistan Papers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this story? Have you been following it? How does what you're hearing from officials' private interviews square with what you remember people saying in public through the war? And if you're a service member or veteran who has served there in Afghanistan, or Iraq for that matter, what does this story mean to you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Afghanistan Papers, a set of thousands of documents and interviews the Washington Post obtained after suing the federal government that show widespread confusion and dysfunction in the war in Afghanistan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does this story square with your feelings about the ongoing American war effort in Afghanistan? Do you see parallels between the war in Afghanistan and the Vietnam War? If you're a service member yourself or the loved one of a service member, what do you think when you hear this story? And do you have questions for our guest about his investigation? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have three quick questions. Number one, how many Americans have we lost in Afghanistan? Number two, how many dollars have we wasted in Afghanistan? And number three, why, after all these many years, can we not just leave?
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know if you have numbers right in front of you, Craig.
Yeah, Tom has three good, succinct questions. So 2,300 U.S. troops have been killed in Afghanistan. More than 20,000 have been wounded during the war. That's, of course, a small number compared to the number of Afghans who have been killed. Overall, more than 150,000 people have died in this war. The United States has spent roughly about $1 trillion during the war. You know, we'll let other people decide if they think it was worth it or not. And the third question as to why can't we get out? Well, it's a lot harder to get out of war than it is to begin one. Right now, President Trump has directed the State Department to negotiate directly with the Taliban to try and cut some kind of deal to withdraw U.S. troops. He's the first president who has authorized direct negotiations with the Taliban. That was something that was always controversial during the Bush and Obama administrations.
Thanks for the call, Tom, at 800-642-1234, as we talked to Craig Whitlock from The Washington Post. Craig, an argument has been made that, okay, the initial mission, preventing al-Qaeda or something like it, from rising in Afghanistan that could target us here in the United States, that part of the mission has been successful. That makes it maybe worth a sustained troop presence. Is that a common argument you hear back to criticisms like Tom's, for example?
It's a very common argument. Military commanders make that all the time, that we need to stay in Afghanistan to make sure that it can no longer once again become a safe haven for al-Qaeda. And I think there's some merit to that argument, but I think there's also some things that don't add up to a lot of people. For one, we have to remember the 9/11 attacks. While Osama bin Laden was hiding out in Afghanistan, the planning for it and the preparations took place in Germany, in Hamburg, Germany, and then the hijackers came to the United States to train. These weren't Afghans who carried out the 9/11 attacks. They were mostly Saudi. Some of them had traveled to Afghanistan, but it wasn't that Afghanistan was really a base of operations for the 9/11 attacks themselves. The other thing is al-Qaeda has really spread around the world. For many years after 9/11, their base of operations were places like Pakistan or Yemen, Somalia, Syria, as well as Europe. So, you know, yes, if we keep troops in Afghanistan, that makes it less likely that a terrorist attack may be launched from there. But, you know, there's any number of other countries where terrorist groups can seek refuge. And, you know, to say that we would occupy them all militarily, of course, isn't feasible.
And Craig, you also rely on your reporting on another set of documents, memos from Donald Rumsfeld, at one point Secretary of Defense, early on in this war effort. He sent out what I think people called snowflakes. Is that right?
That's right. They're sort of memorably described as snowflakes because Rumsfeld would dictate so many of these memos, you know, dozens a day sometimes, that people in the Pentagon talked about how they would flutter down on their desks like snowflakes. He was a very brief writer and dictator memos. He would get right to the point. You know, I'll give you one example that some of these would really raise eyebrows when I first laid eyes on them. Rumsfeld in 2002, October 2002, he writes himself a memo about how he had gone to the White House to meet with President Bush to try and set up a meeting between Bush and two generals. One of the generals was Tommy Franks, who is the U.S. commander for Iraq and the Middle East. And then he told Bush, I want you to meet with another general, General McNeil. And according to the Snowflake memo, Bush replied, well, who's General McNeil? And Rumsfeld said, well, he's the general in charge of Afghanistan. And Bush replied, well, I don't need to meet with him. So that says a lot, that first Bush is entirely focused on the coming invasion of Iraq several months later and completely oblivious as to who his commander in Afghanistan was. And again, this goes all the way back to 2002. But it shows at that time how the Bush administration was really focused on Iraq just, you know, a year after they had started in Afghanistan.
Talking to Craig Whitlock from The Washington Post about his investigation into what's being called the Afghanistan Papers, a bunch of documents, interviews, and more with key principals in the American war and diplomatic effort there. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hello, hi. As I mentioned to the screener, I'm a Vietnam vet, and basically we're seeing Vietnam all over again. A lot of us that were Vietnam vets when we started getting involved in Iraq and Afghanistan just kept saying this is going to be another Vietnam. We're going to get caught up in a quagmire. Actually, this has been going on longer than Vietnam. It's all based on misinformation, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin incident or invading a country like Iraq based on 9/11 and something they weren't even involved in. And basically it's just continuous lies and misdirection. And as far as keeping troops in Afghanistan, there's no reason to keep any troops in Afghanistan. We're talking about preventing the spread of terrorism or Al-Qaeda or whatever. But you're only covering such a minute part of the world that if you put 10,000 troops there and you think you're going to accomplish something, let's face it, they're just going to go somewhere else.
Michael, thanks for the call. Craig, a lot of people seeing echoes of Vietnam, I mean, all through the war in Afghanistan, as Michael has been saying. Do you see that?
Well, I do. And in fact, if you go back to late 2001, when the war started, this immediately became a question or a fear. Would we get stuck in another Vietnam? And President Bush was asked this, and he said directly, you know, no, we've learned our lessons from Vietnam. We're not going to get stuck in a war like that, like we did in Vietnam. And Rumsfeld, once at a press conference, he was mocking people for suggesting we might get stuck in a war like Vietnam. He said, all together now, quagmire. You know, he was mocking people for saying Afghanistan could turn into a quagmire. And, you know, of course, 18 years later, despite that hubris, you know, that's certainly exactly what happened.
Let's bring on another caller. Rich joins us in Portage. Rich, hello.
Hello there. I wanted to make two comments. Number one, it's along the line what you're just talking about, is this battle is war is you're trying to fight an ideology. It's hard to fight an ideology that's been entrenched for decades. Number two is you're using hindsight as judgment based from decisions that they have to make in battle. You have a luxury of hindsight. They don't have that.
Rich, thanks for the call. Let's tackle that second point first, Craig. We are looking back on a lot of these discussions and situations. They were trying to navigate it in the moment.
That's true, although actually the first part of Rich's questions about the ideology is I don't think we really know what we're fighting in those terms. Ironically, Osama bin Laden, when he launched the 9/11 attacks, exactly his goal was to drag the U.S. into a long, costly war in Afghanistan, just like the Soviet Union had done starting in 1979. And not long after that, of course, Soviet Union broke up. And, you know, bin Laden's biggest dream was that the United States would come to Afghanistan and get mired in this very costly, bloody war. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. It's hard to argue otherwise. So in terms of ideology, we kind of fell into his trap, and we're having a heck of a time getting out of it.
Rich, thanks a lot for that call. And staying with that first point that this was about ideology, if it had been just about ideology, it would have been way more simple. It was also about regional differences in Afghanistan, tribal differences, if we want to call them that, systems of patronage that had been there forever. It was way more complicated than just an ideology, right?
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, the Taliban, I think many of them, they see the United States as you know, for to lack a better description other than the cliche, but they see us as, you know, foreign infidels who have come to occupy their country. They're trying to expel us. They have a much different outlook on world affairs than Al-Qaeda does. But that's who we're fighting now, are Afghan insurgents and their allies from the region. But what's remarkable in these Afghanistan papers from these interviews is the number of senior leaders who are very blunt in saying we didn't understand Afghanistan. We didn't have a fundamental idea of what we were doing there. General Douglas Lute, who is the war czar for both Bush and Obama in the White House, said we didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking. And this was a guy who administratively was in charge of the war.
We'll leave it there for now. Craig, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post. He was with us today to talk about the thousands of previously unseen documents he uncovered that show American officials talking in private about the war in Afghanistan and comparing and contrasting their pessimistic messages there with their more optimistic messages to the public. If you want to read the Afghanistan papers and find out more about the reporting that went into it, you can find the stories linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime.